Good evening and welcome to another edition of Ubuntu Radio. I'm here with Miss Megan Foley, otherwise known as the criminal. Those are her words, not mine. Those are her words. And she says she's a criminal because she's figured out ways to hack through life, I think. We're going to go over those ways and those means. She has ended up in a career as a brain
trainer.
A brain trainer. I'm trying to figure out how do you go to school. So I'm trying to think of career day as a kindergartner.
Yeah.
Did you just dress up as like a brain? What did you do here?
No, I think I, in my mind, always wanted to be a con artist. And
I knew it. I knew it. There is that graft in you. I see it. Yeah. I see that graft.
I always wanted to be.
What's your favorite movie?
Right now, I would
say, I think Ocean's 11 because of the theft.
To be honest, you know what is one of my favorites? Aside from maybe Caddyshack, is Lucky Number 7.
God bless you.
Lucky Number 11, have you ever seen it?
Lucky Number 11, that's with Josh something, a guy that was supposed to be a big star in the 90s, but never quite. What was his name? Josh,
Josh Hartnett?
Just never quite, never quite.
Yeah.
He needs your brain hacking. He might have needed your brain hacking in the 90s. He never quite. What was Lucky Number 11? It was a con artist?
No, he actually wasn't a con. It was just kind of like a, well, actually it was a long con. The whole movie was a long con. It was just a really brilliant.
Morgan Freeman was in it?
Morgan Freeman was in it, yeah. It was a story of someone that got kind of the short end of the stick, this kid when he was little, because his family got murdered. Because they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Shit happens. Let's move on, yeah. It's apropos the word con, specifically the long con, because you're a brain trainer.
Yeah.
And getting these habits that allow you to hack into life and to ultimately reach your potential as a human being is a long con. It's not an easy process, but it's something you have to start, and hopefully the dividends are not hopefully. You want them as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
But if you put in the work, they might not be now. But with the consistency of effort, you're hoping that you're going to be able to transform your life and to what we were just talking about, and we're going to get to it. You're going to get to the state of being where you want. Not the things that you want, but a state of being where you want. So that's the purpose of Ubuntu Radio. Today, you're in with Miss Megan Foley, ex-college soccer player, ex-University of New Hampshire. What were they? The Fighting Granites? What were they?
The Wildcats.
The Fighting Wildcats, ex-citizen of the great state of Connecticut, which is the Granite State, I might point out.
No, New Hampshire is.
Which is next to the Granite State, as I might point out. So what is Connecticut?
The Nutmeg State.
So there goes the soccer. That's how you got the soccer
the
thing.
Nutmeg.
The soccer next to the nutmeg. But we'll get into that. So we're here with Megan Foley.
Yeah.
And we're going to have some fun. We're going to have some fun the next couple of minutes. So I know you are one of three or four kids in your family?
Five.
Excuse me?
Five.
Middle kid?
I'm the second oldest.
Second oldest.
Yeah.
And that you were, had to be very responsible at a young age. You know, when we have a picture of Connecticut, we think of Angela Bauer and who's the boss and very plush Greenwich and all that stuff. But, I mean, your story is a little bit different. I think it'll shed some light into what you're doing now.
Yeah. Well, it's actually funny. When I was in school at New Hampshire, and I'd tell people I'm from Connecticut, they'd go, oh, so you're a rich bitch, right?
Right.
And I'd go, not from that part of Connecticut. I was from the poor farm towns of Connecticut.
So what were the parents doing?
My parents?
Yeah.
They did a lot of different things. My mom, I would say, was the original, like, hustler. Scrappy, just do whatever it takes to make it happen, make
like
ends
what?
Meet. She's done a little bit of everything. She was a bus driver. She would drive like our school bus, and then she was driving a shuttle at an airport shuttle. She sold Mary Kay. She got into hypnotherapy at one point. She bartended. She just kind of worked just various jobs. She was a dealer at the casino. That one she actually stuck with for a while because it was really good money. She worked nights, but yeah, she was a dealer. I tell people my mom was a dealer at the casino. They're like, what was she dealing, drugs? I was like, no, to keep things on the up and up. But yeah, so she was a dealer at the casino for a while. And my dad, contractor, so he painted houses and worked on houses and had his own business with a cousin of his. It's just an awesome person. Was really great at his work, but not great at, say, the business part of it.
So your dad, that is,
yeah,
not the cousin.
My dad, yeah, my dad. The cousin, yeah, was not great at that either, but my dad was not great at, you know, asking people to give him money. Like, yes, I just did this great job in your house, but now it's time for you to pay me. So I think people just would kind of put him off. Be like, oh, I'll get checks in the mail, you know.
Gotcha.
So he got into that and just was never really great at, you know, charging what he was worth and, you know, demanding people pay him. So, you know, his business was not successful. And so he really struggled. And they had this store, and this was back in the 80s. And so they put up the house that we had for collateral, and the business started to struggle. And because the house was up for collateral, we ended up losing the house. So that kind of launched my parents into a downward spiral.
So from house to an apartment, or how did it work?
From there, we moved to a house that we were renting. And then we moved every couple of years, basically, because I think it would get kind of like, you know, my dad would be waiting on money and then would kind of put off the landlord. And then all of a sudden, landlords after a while, like, okay, you owe me, like, you guys got to move now. So, yeah, we moved. We were in the next house, I think, that one we stayed in for maybe like 6 or 7 years. And then they kind of hit we had to move. I think we had like 2 weeks to move. And my dad somehow found us another place to live. And I'm probably 14 or 15 now. Yeah, my brother's a baby. I have a baby brother, and I have 2 younger kids. So my older sister and I, it was like her and I, and then we said the little guys. So
how much of a separation in age from you and your sister, who are about a year apart?
A year and a half, about 2 years.
Maybe. To the other siblings who at this point are children. We're talking like five,
yeah.
Six or younger.
So I'm 14. My next sister is 5 years younger than me. So was at 9.
Mm-hmm.
And then Billy, 7. And then Timmy was an infant. So like newborn baby.
So you're saying mom is at the
casino.
You're, yeah, taking care of the kids at, yeah, night as a 14, 15-year-old. Sister's helping?
Yeah.
Or she's out trying to work to make extra money? Or?
Well, we both kind of worked on the weekends. So I think by the time I was 15...
Doing what at 14, 15?
She worked at a restaurant, a little breakfast place, a town or so away. And she'd pick up some shifts, waiting tables. And because she, like, my cousin worked there, got my sister a job. And then I was about 15 and they started letting me take shifts. So it was like a little coffee place. So I'd pick up shifts there too. But in addition to that, I mean, we had high school, we had sports, like we were full on athletes, you know, all 3 seasons. So, we're doing all that and trying to be like normal teenage kids and have this sort of secret other life where we come home and like have a family to raise.
So mom would leave for the casino. What time?
When we would get home from like sports, she'd head out probably around then, like dinner time. So we would take on dinner. Sometimes maybe she'd make dinner. Mostly it would be, we would kind of just come home from school and like parents would just sort of do their work thing. We would just do the family thing. And then she'd get home in the morning about when we were heading out to school. So we'd swap cars basically. She'd drive home, give us the car, and we'd be off to school. And this is what she said, oh, there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. I got bills to pay, I got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know I can't slow down, I can't hold back. Though you know I wish I could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good. My dad was a little, he fluctuated a little bit. He kind of, at one point, kind of started hanging out with like not a great crowd. So,
when you say not a great crowd, are we talking mobsters? Are we talking...
No. They were just like druggies. So.
Did he ever use?
Yeah. So he became. I mean, I don't know how heavily, but basically, we only knew this in hindsight. Basically, he kind of showed like he just wasn't around as much. He was kind of coming home later and later, sleeping all day, just sort of not as present and more irritable or whatever. And we just kind of like locked it in. It was just like, you know, all hands on deck. You know, the kids really just forged together as our team. It was like us and then, you know, mom and dad kind of just doing the best they could. that point, there really wasn't, maybe my older sister a little bit, but for the most part, there really wasn't a whole lot of, like, hate or disruption. It was like, you're just in it. Like, I think I told you, like, I just sort of turned off emotion. Like, I turned that faucet off because it was like a, you just got to do what's best at this point. Like,
this feelings, is at feelings early are teenage ineffective. Years, or this is something that you thought you, in hindsight, looking back, you started doing that.
No.
8, 9 years old.
No, I did it around this time when
conscious decision.
Yeah. Because emotions are not effective. Correct. Like, my sister, if she was would get stressed out about things, like, my goal was basically to, like, balance the two. So when I was young, I just sort of developed this, I would say, like, a high level of social intelligence. So I was hypersensitive to social cues. My family, they were all drinkers. And if you actually ever look at the research, there's actually a high correlation to people that are around that type of situation when they're young.
To develop a heightened sense of emotional intelligence.
Yeah. They become hypersensitive to social cues. That was essentially me. So I just would become that buffer and just try and, like, okay, what can I do to keep, like, my older sister from not feeling too stressed, from my parents from not feeling, like, worthless or whatever, and how can we be that middleman? And I remember deciding many, many times, there's just no place for emotion. Like, it doesn't work. Like, there's just, it's a waste of time, it's a waste of energy, because at the end of the day, you just gotta get it done.
That becomes troublesome in early adulthood when you start to try to forge relationships with the other sex, but I'm sure we're going to get there. I think we're going to get there. We'll get there soon, so I can see what's coming.
It does have a backlash.
I think I see what's coming. It forces us to grow up very quickly, and it's a benefit, at least it was a benefit for me academically, because I took on the responsibility, the same one that was in the household. I mirror that at school, and so one thing was feeding off the next. But what's interesting about you, and we're going to bring this up, is that you were not a good student. You did not decide. What did you say? You had the George Bush mentality. C's were what?
C's get degrees.
C's get degrees. You and George W. Bush.
Yeah.
Did the parents never said anything about that, or they were in their
my
own?
My dad was always about the sports. So, you know, as long as you can.
And what sport did you play? I'm going to say all of them, right?
Yeah. I played soccer and softball were really my main two. And in the wintertime, I'd ski, so I'd do ski club.
But you're not from the rich part of Connecticut?
I'm not. I know, surprisingly. And I don't know how we ever afforded it, but they find. And this was actually the great thing. My parents had really several great things that they did. They would openly admit they did a lot of things wrong, as a lot of parents do. A few things that they did really, really well is they always made sure we could laugh at ourselves. They always made sure we were, like, they promoted loyalty. So it was, like, they'd give the shirt off their backs for us. So if it meant, like, the gas bill or rent might get held up to pay for my soccer cleats or my ability to go on the ski trip or whatever, they would do that so that we could have and feel and, like, not have to feel like we need to short ourselves in any way. So they really went out of their way to do that. And I, you know, to this day am, you know, grateful, so grateful of a lot of the great things that they did. Like, that we always knew everybody loved each other. Even when my dad was kind of going through a rough period and wasn't really there, able to communicate or talk or be, like, say, he didn't do the I love yous and hugs. But we just kind of knew, like, he cared about us. Like, he made a point to be at every soccer game, every like, major event we had sports-wise. Like, that was his way of showing that we were bonded in some way. So they did some things not so awesome, but they did a lot of things that were really great. And I think that was really helpful and kept us going. So of all emotions, the one that I maintained was that ability to just, like, let's make this. Like, I remember my mom sitting my older sister and I down that time we had to move. We had 2 weeks to go. And she's like, all right, so we got to be out of the house and we've got 2 weeks. So we're gonna treat this like an adventure, and we're gonna just, cause we're gonna have to get
Megan, rid of it. Megan, you're how old at this point?
At this point, I'm like 14 or 15. Okay, so like, age. We're gonna have to get rid of the dog. We're gonna have to like, just go, like dad found his place, but you know, like we have to like really cut down. We're just gonna jam into this house. So we gotta make the best of it. Like, how are we gonna do it? It's gonna be fun. We gotta like make this exciting, like buffer it for the kids if we can. So again, it was us.
So at that point,
us as like
you
the
were,
parent entity right. and the little guys.
So that was it, okay. Mm-hmm. So you guys, at that point, they recognized the things that you were doing because they were not there. And they gave you credit for co-parenting in a sense. And you
right.
guys, you and
like
your oldest sister were, it was a foursome.
It was. Since I was a young child, rules didn't make sense to me. I'd follow a rule if it met like my needs, right? Like if it's aligned with something that I want or need or makes sense to me. If it didn't make sense, I didn't get why I have to follow a rule just because you tell me to. So I had been doing that since I was very, very little. So when it came to school, well, now I have this huge adult responsibility and life, your perspective shifts a little bit. Like the things that you deem important, they're different, whether you like it or not. It doesn't seem as important that I ace this quiz or spend hours studying for something that I might never use or don't even enjoy doing when I have like actual life responsibilities that I'm dealing with. Like it doesn't seem as important to bitch about the boy who didn't call me back or the quasi friend that's talking about me or whatever. Like to me, it's like, it just became like, stuff's just not important. Like, why would I even get into any of that drama? First of all, I don't have time, certainly don't have the energy. So I just streamlined my thought process and my perspective. And so that's where I talk to you about that concept of like perceptual agility. Like, what's the most effective for me to think in this moment? That's what I'm going to think. And that's what I'm gonna do.
So we're gonna get to perceptual agility. We're gonna get to a lot of stuff later on, but we're on Ubuntu Radio talking with Megan Foley, the criminal. Criminal-minded.
Criminal-minded.
You can live with that. She's not a criminal, she's criminal-minded.
Yeah.
And I mean, let's explain that for anybody who just jumped in. We're not saying that you are going to prison, that you're deviant. We're saying that you figured out ways, alternative ways, to get the things that you want.
Live life on my terms.
You're a damn criminal. You are. You're a damn
criminal.
Well,
I mean, I think it's living life on your terms and still maybe
what gives you
the
gall to do that? Everybody wants to do that, but nobody can.
Yeah, you
know.
Why
you? Why you, Megan?
I would say part of it is probably just like my nature. Maybe I came out of the womb confident or something. I think it was more curiosity than anything. I just was just curious if I could test the limits. And again, my parents, one of the things that they did well was they never tried to make any of us a certain way. Like my sister is very different than me, and they sort of just allowed and fostered that. And then I came along and was like that, like wild child.
Give us an example of this wild child in you.
My sister used to piss me off because when we were little, she wouldn't let me play with her. And her and my-
She was how old again? How much older than you?
A year and a half or 2 years or so. Oh. Her and my cousin were like best friends, and they used to play together, and they were way cooler because they were older than me. And they would do things like, my cousin was kind of bitchy to me, and she would control my sister, like whatever she said goes. And my sister would like feel bad sometimes, be like, well, maybe Megan can play with us. And my cousin Kelly would be like, no, if she wants, she can sit. So that my sister's bedroom is at the top of the stairs. She can sit at the top of the stairs outside the door and listen to us play, but she can't actually play with us. So they do stuff like that. So I'd just be sitting there, just kind of, I'm sure all kids go through stuff like this. And I'd come downstairs and my mom would be like, what happened? And they're like, well, they wouldn't let me play with it, you know? And then if I told on them, of course, that's worse for you. You don't tell on people. And so I just would find ways to get back at her. So there's one time she got sick. So she got the cold or something like that. And so my dad was like, oh, you know, Janet. So my mom's named Janet. Go down. I think there's some cough syrup in the cabinet or whatever. I hear that. I sprint downstairs. I grabbed the cough syrup and I drank all of it so she couldn't have any. There's another time.
And that made you feel good.
Yeah.
Right. You didn't have any issues after that. No.
I'm not getting sick.
God, you're not getting sick at all.
I don't know why. It had to do with me ingesting the stuff. This is actually kind of funny as I tell these stories. There's another
time. So what happened? I want to know what happened with the cough syrup in you.
Nothing. I was fine. She just couldn't have it. They had to actually go to the store and buy new cough syrup. But in my head, I was like, haha, got her there. Meanwhile, I just ingested a whole bottle of cough syrup. Well, and didn't tell anybody.
Straight to sleep?
Yeah. I don't know. I just remember being so satisfied. It didn't matter what happened at that point.
One of the things that you've mentioned before we started this sort of line of question and answer.
Interrogation.
No, I'm not interrogating. We're having a conversation. It's a wonderful conversation. You're sharing. The fact that you're stopping going, my God, I don't know if I should share this. Yes. Keep pushing forward, Foley. Keep going. Keep going with the criminal deviancy. Mm-hmm. But I do want to get back to one thing, because education is incredibly important to me. Mm-hmm. And that transition from middle school to high school or high school to college is key in terms of emotional stability and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we also said that you were not committed to education because there were other things going on in your life, just practically, like, I gotta go home and take care of kids. As English tests in the long run ain't that important. So high school, you're still a good student, C's enough to graduate, you graduate, yeah, in Connecticut, then you go to the University of New Hampshire to play soccer. Mm-hmm. And you were a jock. You didn't give a shit about school.
Yeah, actually, I remember I was...
First of all, you were incredibly good soccer player. You were All-State in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. As a what position?
Defender.
Okay. Played club, top club teams.
Well, what's funny about it is I'm a sophomore in high school. I don't think, own a soccer ball. I just played the sport and happened to be good at it. Or I was an athlete. I don't know. I didn't know how good I was. And I knew kind of with this family dynamic that I probably needed an out. Obviously, we didn't have money. I didn't know what college loan. I wasn't even thinking in that realm. This kind of thing. I probably need an out. I got to get out of here at some point. And I'm a sophomore in high school, and one of my coaches had mentioned, like, you could play in college. Like, you have that capability. And I kind of was playing with that idea. And so I landed on my goal was, I'm going to go play Division I. I'm going to get a scholarship because I hear that's something you can do. So my guidance counselor sits me down and he's like, so, you know, Megan, do you have aspirations of going to college? And I was like, yep, I definitely want to go to college. He's like, great. You know, what do you want to study? Have you, you know, what? So he's an education focused, right? And I was like, oh, I don't care about any of that. I want to go play D1 and get a scholarship. And he looks at me and he goes, don't you think maybe you're being a little bit unrealistic? And he proceeds to say things like, do you realize if you went for something like that and you didn't succeed, how much it might burden your family to go through something like that? I mean, to really, like, reach for something that's unobtainable and unrealistic.
But why was he saying that? Was your high school just not that good?
Right. We were in the middle of nowhere. We were not sort of on the map, which ironically, in my sophomore year, that season, we ended up winning All-State. We won the state finals. Prior to that, no, we were middle of nowhere town, not on the map at all. We were a tri-town high school. We had to, like, pull three towns together, mm-hmm, just to make a high school. And he was like, wouldn't it be more realistic to stay close to home, maybe go to a community college, just, wow, focus on getting your classes? You don't even play on a club team. What do you, I mean, don't you think this is basically just don't set yourself up for failure. This will be really bad when you fail. And so I walked out of there and, I had some choice words for him, but I walked out of there, you know, went back to my class or whatever, came home from school, and my mom was like, what did you do? And I was like, well, I fired my guidance counselor. I was like, I didn't know if you could do that, but I didn't like what he was saying to me, so I feel like it was better for me to do that than to tell him how I really felt. And she's like, why did you fire him? And I told her what he said, and she's like, okay, I agree with you. I was like, but he did have a point. I think I need to get on a club team. So that fall, I had a friend who played on a club team, and I just like showed up at practice one day or something. Or they had a, she told me, she's like, we had one player that was out or something. Like basically they maybe had an opening. I didn't go to tryouts, I didn't do anything like that. I just sort of showed up and was like, hey, would you guys let me play with you? And the coach was kind of like, I guess, like, we'll see how it goes. And usually that's all it took. Just put me on the field and I'll be someone that you want to keep on your team. And so that happened the next season as well. I had a coach who had...
So that day, was it immediate, like next day? I mean, you leave in practice, he comes over to you. I think you should be on the team.
Yeah, it was a, you're coming to the next game, right? Like you, we, uh-huh. Yeah, for sure. Uh-huh. So it didn't take much. It really was like, you let me
starting
show up one time.
Mm-hmm. The next game.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not a very good coach. You give you a couple of weeks to work your way in.
Or he's got an eye for talent. Could be a great coach.
You know what he is? He's a coach that wants to win over development and the cohesiveness of the team.
Well, so this is the thing about my style of play. I was a scrappy
criminal
player, and I was fearless. I didn't care who I was playing against. My approach is always, I actually want to be matched up with the best player because how hard can it be? I got to see if I can, you know, I'm
what were you always trying to prove, Foley?
To see how good I could be. I mean, I had a lot of, not from like my immediate family, but from extended family, there was always a lot of, that's unrealistic. You know, you can't do that. Don't color outside the lines. What are you thinking? Lots of just judgment and put downs and just, you know, stay in your box. You know, and I just was never naturally like that. I didn't like it. And so there was for a long time in my life, and I still will use that sometimes occasionally, is that motivator of tell me I can't, I dare you. If you tell me I can't, that's exactly what I'm gonna do. And so I leveraged that and it brought me a lot of success. So
here's a question for you.
Yeah.
Switching topics a bit, but
yeah.
I think we're gonna get to where we want to.
Right.
No.
Back to school.
No, this is serious here. Going off the definitions that you've sort of hinted at, do women who want to achieve the things they want have to take on a more criminal, in your sense of the word, behavior, get the things that they want in life, meaning deviate, be deviant, be unexpected. You talk about people in your family not expecting you to go here, this male guidance counselor not expecting you to do that. Obviously, you don't have to be a woman to have those people in your lives try to doubt you, but I would assume because you were, it might have made them easier to say that. And we've had other conversations about sort of the thousand knife pricks of abuse that are more damning than the one big hammer blow. Mm-hmm. So, do women have to be criminal to be themselves?
If I want to put on, say, my performance psychology lens, really what you're talking about is a threat versus challenge approach. So it's framing any given situation as a challenge versus a threat. So for me, I would joke about, you know, I do some of these things just to see what I can, you know, what crazy situations I can talk my way out of. But it's really having the willingness to go into those situations, the unknown to begin with, and look at it like it's a challenge. Like, let's just see what I'm made of. You know, like when I'm going up against one of the top players in the state in soccer, everybody knows this girl's name. She's being recruited by UNC. She's just some superstar. So this is actually how I got recruited to go to UNH. It was a Senior Bowl game, postseason. Kind of I've missed my opportunity, so to speak, of going to this specific school. And for whatever, you know, turn of fate, the assistant coach was there, but also the head coach happened to come on that trip. I showed up and I accidentally grabbed two left feet cleats. And there's a keeper there who had a set of spikes that were two sizes too big for me. So they were like clown shoes. She's like, if you wanna, you can wear my, you know, size 10s or whatever, size 9s. I was like, yeah, let's do it. And so this other girl was going to be on the other team, this, you know, superstar everybody knows. And I was like, I want to mark that girl.
What was her name?
Rachel. I don't forget her last name. Rachel something.
Mm-hmm.
It's like snowing, freezing cold. Like for no reason should I have been able to play in that game or done well in that game. And I shut that girl down. She didn't score a goal. She didn't do anything. I just made it my job that whole game because I was just so curious. Like Like, how far off am I from her? You know, she's got this prestige and this title, and she's like this phenomenal athlete. And I gotta know, can I, like, where do I stand next to her? And that's not necessarily someone in my ear saying that I can't do it. That's my curiosity, me looking at that as a challenge. Like, I could have asked to mark someone else. I could have hid in the back. I could have just not played because I didn't have my cleats. But screw all that. I'll run around with my clown shoes and I'll make it work because I just gotta know. I wanna feel what that's like. I'm looking at this as a challenge. You know, we can get into that whole perception of like criminal or being willing to deviate that fearlessness as we talk through this. But initially it's about having that willingness to look at things as a challenge, just to see what you're made of versus a threat, like what will people think or what will happen if I lose or whatever. Like we played golf the other day and I won. Yes, the day where you won. And I said, because you were putting from the fairway.
That's
basically
how you play golf.
No, it's not.
You get the ball in the hole.
This is a situation.
Like soccer, you get the ball in the hole.
This is a situation.
You're putting
from the fairway.
What are you talking about? I'm putting from the fairway. I'm around the green.
Can I finish my story?
Whose podcast is this? My good friend, Henry Gutierrez, is one of the best golfers I've ever seen, said, Aronde, when you start playing golf, if you can putt, putt. If you're playing a par three and you want to tee the ball up, tee the ball up. Do whatever criminal type behavior it takes, as long as it doesn't go over the edge of sportsmanship, which it didn't.
So
I'm cutting from
again,
off the
this
green.
This is not about you. This is about me.
It is about me.
What did I do? Do you remember?
You lost. That's all I
said. So there is a shot, and this happened several times. There's a shot where you probably would have putted that shot. I said, I want to work on this chip
shot.
That's
great for
you. I want to master that. So I know I'm risking not making this, not doing it well, but I gotta know. I'm looking at that as a challenge.
You're so brave.
No, this is an example. Stop
You're
putting
so
me
brave.
Down. It is subtly.
I'm not.
But I looked at
I'm
it
not,
as a challenge.
And I see the subtlety. It's glaring.
I gotta challenge myself and get there.
You're
because
so good.
I gotta know how I can be.
You're so good. There was never any point in that showcase where you said, I'm from no-name town, no-name high school, no-name family. I'm going to fucking prove you wrong because you have everything. There's none of that part of it? You said the challenge. There is not that part that says, you got everything, I got nothing.
I don't know that you have
everything.
I'm asking. No, there isn't.
There's not a sliver of that?
No, if I use that or leverage that, I do it deliberately. So again, it comes into like I've fine-tuned that whole perceptual agility thing where I'm very deliberate
and
about
we're gonna get to that.
what I choose to think and when, because it's the most efficient way for me to
But
think.
How do you do that as a 19-year-old when you don't even have the definitions of these terms yet? You didn't know
what
perceptual agility.
I was doing it as a 14-year-old.
I understand
because
that.
I was deciding, okay, this just doesn't work. It makes no sense. And yeah, there might be a part of me that is sort of maybe naturally inclined, again, to be a little bit more confident or be a little bit more fearless. I also had environmental factors and opportunities for me to go one way or the other. And I chose to go with viewing something as a challenge and putting myself out there just to see what happens. And not letting that whole, what are people going to think of me, affect me in a negative way. I'd only allow it if it would enhance my performance. So if I'm thinking nobody believes in me, they're going to doubt me, everyone's doubting me, I can be thinking that and it gets in my head and now all of a sudden it's hindering my performance. I never allowed that. It was, I'll only use that if it's going to give me that extra edge. If that makes me just that, you know, puts me into my zone. Like you get me a little pissed off and I'm on it. Get out of my way. So if I need to turn that on for some reason, I'll cue that up. If I don't, then I don't care what people think about me.
Difficult thing to do as a teenager, not to care. Now, no. Obviously, looking back now, but I'm talking about the 95% of teenagers out there who want to get to this place. But because of the environment, because of the circumstances that you had to deal with, it's almost as if life created the perfect mechanism for you to get to this idea of perceptual agility, because before even knowing the definition or being able to put those words, hack those words together, you were practicing what the meaning was. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old out there who wants to, but just I mean, their life is not mom working at a casino and dad maybe being an alcoholic, and their life is decent, but they want more, but the environment is not forcing them to be more. We're going to get to ways and means you can help those kids hack into life and get to the kind of understanding and honestly the power.
Right.
Because this is what teenagers crave. The power to make decisions, the power to act on the self-belief, the power to not give a fuck what anybody else thinks. But here's the difference. They do, and it hinders their progress. So I want you to at least address the reality of that. Looking back now, you can go, well, I know, and again, you're a brain
trainer.
So part of this is advertising your brain training business. We're going to get to basically, where can these people go and see your brain training at work? Where can they go?
www.opthrive.com.
O-P-T.
H-R-I-V-E.
And what do you do?
What do I do?
Yeah, what do I do? Let me get to the elevator speech and then we'll come back to it later on.
Well, I train optimal performance. So I train the characteristics, attributes, skills most associated with resilience and elite performers. My background isn't that, you know, dysfunction model of psychology. It's actually the front side of the model. Like, what does right look like? What are the best of the best doing across all fields, not just sports, like across any areas of life? They took a look at that and said, okay, what are the commonalities here? And believe it or not, they found some. And believe it or not, they were trainable. So they've kind of whittled this down. It's not only are, you know, some people may be naturally more inclined for some of these things, but they're also trainable skills. So, you know, one of the things that I would say I do a lot of in my profession is kind of reverse engineering processes. So I'll talk with you, and as I talk with you, as I play sports with you, I'm watching your process. I'm not necessarily watching if you got the victory or not. I'm watching how you did it, what was your approach, what are all the steps to how you created that, and I can actually reverse engineer your process and take it out and then show you how to put it into another area. I mean, that's what the field is a lot about, is, you know, how do we elicit these processes that are really working for us and use them in other areas? And then how do we incorporate new processes to replace ones that are not working for us?
So we're gonna get to that later on. We're going to talk a little bit about what Megan the Criminal Foley does now in terms of hacking her way through life and giving you the kinds of skills and tools that are going to enable you to feel, and that's the zenith, that's the end goal. The end goal, the end game, is to feel what you want, not necessarily to get what you want, because the things that you want really revolve around a feeling, because those things disappear. We all know that. You can't take everything with you, but the feeling is what's motivating and driving you. So we're going to get to that, but I want you to answer and address the question about the kid, the teenager,
right,
who does not really know anything about perceptual agility, doesn't know anything about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, doesn't know anything about psychology, doesn't know anything about emotional empathy, emotional intelligence, but they're just sitting there going, I want to be at Z. I'm at A. There's a lot of letters in between here and there, and I have no idea.
So as soon as you announce and say, either in generalizing that population or in that population generalizing themselves, is this is difficult, that sends a certain signal to your brain and will create your reality, will shift your perception to say, okay, it's difficult. It doesn't care what that word means. It just says, okay, difficult. Let's make that difficult. Let's shape everything to make it difficult. So it doesn't have to be. And you talk about, oh, well, that person didn't have the struggle to force them to be, you know, open to things. The struggle can drive you one way or the other. When they actually do research on what makes kids who are resilient, really resilient, having a strong support, even if it's just one person that's like some role model that is in their life, it can help. That's, it's all you need. So it's all, if anything, it's almost easier. So I say this, anything that you do, anything that you think, you say, you feel. You do that more than once, you do that over and over again, it's a pathway formed from your brain down to your body. So anything that you think has a neural connection all the way down to your body. It initiates a certain feeling, initiates chemical responses in your body, it impacts your physiology. And the more you do that, you reinforce that pathway. So no matter what, you're reinforcing something. So now that you know that, you get to choose what you're going to reinforce. If what you're reinforcing doesn't work for you, then you do something different by thinking something different, by acting a different way, by triggering yourself in a different way. You have choice in every situation. It's the environment is obsolete. No one makes you feel a certain way. Nothing outside of you forces you to do or be something. It's your perception of that situation that dictates how you feel and how you perceive the world. And I know that that sounds probably crazy to some people, but it's absolutely true.
How long did it take you to get to that understanding? That at 14?
I think that I was searching at that point because I think that there's a component of me that felt, you know, I talk now about how much choice that you have. Like I felt a little bit like, you know, circumstances in my life. I joke now, like, oh, I raised 3 kids and 2 parents that weren't mine.
You illegitimate bastard.
No, I think that there's a component, especially at 14, where I felt like things were out of my control. Like maybe some of that victim, like this is being forced upon me. You know, as much as I loved, I mean, I love my family. I loved my brother. And at the time, my baby brother, I loved kind of like a mom. And there was still this very clear sense that this isn't my choice. Like I don't, he isn't my child. And I shouldn't I should be able to just be whining about, you know, the boy that didn't call me right. Or whatever. Like,
God, what is his name? That's the second time you mentioned him.
Boy?
What is this kid? What is his name?
Boy?
What's he doing now?
I forget.
You don't care. What's he doing now?
I really don't. Yeah.
People need shit for character?
No. I don't believe that they do. I think that you can decide your own polarity. If it takes you a really long time to get these concepts, you might be drawing in more polarity in your life than you need. I think if you start to get it, you know, you can be the kid from the happy home that has money, that, you know, has a good life and still learn these things. You could probably go get there faster if you wanted. I think there's value in struggle because it really, you know, puts your back against the wall and, you know, makes you look at your shit and makes you react. And that can force you to react without thinking. So you start building pathways that are not effective because you probably have a lot of examples of what wrong looks like. Whereas maybe that person from, say, the happy home, so to speak, they don't have a whole lot of examples of what wrong looks like. Like their baseline is actually a pretty stable baseline. So a lot of ways they have a leg up, and if they frame it that way, they have an advantage. At the same time, the kid that doesn't have the happy home also could have a leg up because they've got the struggle to show them a lot of what wrong looks like. They don't have to make those mistakes. Like no matter what your situation is, you can see it as advantageous. You just have to choose to see it that way.
Perceptual agility.
Perceptual agility.
Do you identify as a working class white woman from Connecticut?
Never use those words.
I didn't think so.
No.
The politics of America dictate that that's what you are. So
no.
There we go.
I would never.
But I'm saying in the conversation that I had with you, you always define yourself in terms of the psychology, mm-hmm. in terms of who you are, what you believe, what you perceive.
Mm-hmm.
But looking from the outside, you were a working class white woman from Connecticut. Does that ever factor into who you are in terms of looking back?
It doesn't even like resonate with me.
Mainly my point is that people don't talk about that reality anymore. Working class white folks. There's a president who's now the president because
I just don't see the benefit. How would that serve me? Like what would be the point of, and that's really my approach is like, I could look at anything through any lens. What's the one that's going to get me the most benefit? Working white class woman. I don't.
Working class white woman.
Oh, Working white class. Working class white woman.
From Connecticut.
See, I can't even say it. It's
I know, it's all
jumbled.
It's good.
Just random words. I don't see the benefit. What would be the point? It sounds so like meh. I sound like a face in the crowd.
You don't want to be. Ever.
No. No. Mm-mm.
Who do you want to be then? Let's get to your end game. Who do you want to be?
Well, me. I am very congruent with who I am. And like the good, the bad, the ugly, the criminal. I'm great with that.
Let's redefine the criminal now. We've been talking for about 50 minutes. You're on Ubuntu Radio with Megan Foley, who is a brain...
Trainer,
among other things. And she's introducing us to the concept of the perceptual agility. If you've been listening for the last couple of minutes, it's the idea, and correct me if I'm wrong. Actually, why am I defining it? It's your term. Mm. What is perceptual agility?
It's the ability to choose how you're going to view something through the lens that's going to serve you the most in that situation. And I can...
But how do you know, you said the lens is going to serve you in that situation.
Yeah.
If I'm unable to assess the situation correctly, how do I know the appropriate lens?
Doesn't matter as long as you choose what's going to work, right? So I feel like what you're talking about a little bit is like, what if I'm not, like, what if I don't know the truth of the reality of the situation?
Correct.
That's all gray. It's all there is your perception. That is your reality. So let me give you an example. This is kind of a fun one.
Well, we'll figure out if it's fun or not. I don't know.
Yeah.
If it's ever or not.
So a few years back, I took an internship where I had the opportunity to go work with LA Galaxy. So I'm a female. Oh, I'm older than the other interns. That doesn't really matter. It's really mainly...
So how old are you at this point?
I was 31, maybe?
Oh my God, ancient. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, I get to go intern, so I get to go work with the first team.
Isn't that the Beckham years?
No, this is...
Kobe Jones
Landon,
still playing?
No, Donovan is on the team.
Bruce Arena's the coach?
Bruce is the coach,
okay.
Yep. And so I don't know anybody's names. I've never been like a sports fan to the point where I know, especially with soccer, for whatever reason, even though that was my sport, I got that they were professionals, but at the same time I was like, you know, they're just people to me. So anyway, I know this is a big opportunity. So I'm here. I get to go observe, you know, their practices and be involved with their team. And I've only been there for maybe a week or so. But periodically, they'll let guest, like, teams come. So this particular day, they had, I think, the USC, maybe, or UCLA men's soccer team came to watch the practice. And they had a handful of reporters that were there to interview some of the guys because they had a big game coming up that weekend. And if you know me at all, I don't have a filter, so I tend to... you know, have a little playful banter. I just can't help it with whoever I'm around. I don't care who you are. Like, I'm just being me. So I had a little bit of banter with some of these guys at some point in that whole week that I was there, which is not very long. So this particular day, I'm the only female on the field. There's the LA Galaxy, UCLA men's soccer team, bunch of reporters, and after practice, they'll kind of shoot the shit a little bit. Some of the guys will actually, like, grab balls and, like, shoot for crossbars, and a couple of these guys go, I think it was the first four or five that went, all go and shoot for crossbars, and all of a sudden, every single one of them miss. Like, first four or five, every single one of them miss. So I can't help it, I have no filter. I say, make some comment, some smart-ass comment, like, you know, you guys call yourselves professionals? Like, what the hell is that about? So, one of the players yells from behind, "Let's see if the girl can do it." Now, it's like the record has scratched. The entire field has notated this because they've all noticed that I'm there. Everyone has now turned their attention to me. Now, they don't know I played soccer.
Division I college soccer.
Right, and I haven't played soccer. I haven't even touched a soccer ball in probably 2 years. I haven't warmed up. I'm wearing, like, crappy gym shoes. Lots of factors not in my favor. And I just can't help myself. So without skipping a beat, I'm calling out to whoever's in the net, like, toss me a ball. And I'm walking up to the 18-yard line. And in that moment, I could have been thinking, holy fuck, everybody's watching me. This is a make or break moment. I'm gonna embarrass myself. They're expecting me to lose. I haven't touched a soccer ball. I'm gonna, and even when I played, I told you, I'm a defender. So I never shot for crossbars. I don't know how to fucking do this. And I'm thinking none of that. If any of those thoughts came to my mind, they were immediately gone because that's not gonna serve me in that moment. The only thing that's serving me in that moment is looking at the crossbar exactly where I'm gonna hit the ball. So I grab the ball, I walk up to 18-yard box. One of the guys says, well, if you want, you can move it a little closer. All I need to hear, tell me I can't. So I put it there, and what do you think happened?
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
First shot, hit the crossbar?
Crushed it.
Reporters go wild.
Yeah. If I ever had a drop the mic moment, that was it.
And you
I looked, walk away, keep walking down. I looked at my other buddy who's an intern. I was like, he was like, holy fuck, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen. I was like, yeah, we gotta get out of here now. I can't do that again.
Did you run out? Did you jog off or did you walk away?
I just did this. No, you gotta walk casual and smooth in that moment. And everyone was just like, from that day on,
Landon,
I got known.
Landon shouted you out?
I got known, yeah. I got known as the chick who hit the crossbar. And they actually learned my name at that point.
Is there a statue of you at the LA Galaxy?
Yeah.
The LA Galaxy practice for the Steelers.
The most badass chick ever walked these streets.
The most badass. Shut your mouth.
Yeah. I was like, that's how it's done, guys. And then I walked away.
I can't believe that has always been there. There have been moments of doubt in your life. So obviously it took years to get to that point where, so I would assume, I mean, just as a teenager, there's never been a moment where you said, I can't. It's hard to believe.
It doesn't last. That's the thing. Cause it just.
So then do you think you're genetically predisposed to this sort of condition?
No.
So then we go back to the argument that you have to have these elements in your life to create this thing. You say that, well, the same state of consciousness, the same state of confidence can be had from a position of privilege. And
You have people backing you.
But this is something I've been thinking about. I don't want to bring race into it, but I think we're going to get on it a little bit. Part of it, because for 20 years I've been thinking about this, the idea of the typical black person is American, some poor person, and you have to strive and work harder, work 10 times as hard as the next person to get what you want. So I've always had this theory that blackness is defined, and we're not going to get off this topic for long, but just to make an analogy, I've always thought that blackness was defined in American culture from a position of struggle, from a position of the underclass rising up. And the issue over the last 40 years is that our lives have gotten better as black people, as the underclass in this country. So we have not had to struggle as much. And if you define a position, if your identity is that of overcoming struggle, and then you don't have to struggle, then what is your identity?
Right.
So I find it interesting that you're saying, because I've always been trying to figure out, then how do you define blackness today when we have more affluence, there are more people in blah, 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 blah. So what you're saying, I am hearing, okay, my hack is, okay, how can I then couch this as you don't have to struggle to define blackness? Because for the 400 years of this country, the history, the political history of this country is defining blackness as struggle. And the spatterings of the definition of blackness we've seen in the culture the past couple of years, the police shootings, it's a power imbalance. It's a police officer who has a position of authority trying to put somebody who does not down. So it's reinforcing that idea that's been alive for 400 years. But the statistics say otherwise. The statistics say we're doing better.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the majority, in the norm, in a broad swath of people, we are doing better. So my whole notion is then, how do you still define the mindset that you have when there's really nobody really putting dogs and hoses and telling you, no, 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 they're still doing it, but it's not as obvious. We run.
You know what's fascinating about that? So again, that whole precision language thing I mentioned before, as soon as you announce like this, it's hard for that 14-year-old to think the way I think. And they then say, yeah, it's hard to think, blah. They've framed themselves, they've primed themselves to seek evidence to prove that that's true. So now all of a sudden it has to become hard even when it wasn't. So in a situation that you could take either way, one person could probably say it wasn't hard, but you're going to say it was hard because you've primed yourself to think that.
Historically, it's always been hard.
And it's going to continue to reinforce your perception. Mm-hmm. Now, by you saying to be black is to live a life of struggle,
right.
If you're in a scenario of struggle, it serves you to think that way. If you're no longer in a scenario of struggle, and you don't have to speak for your entire population, you can speak for you, because that's how you're going to start to break that, then you got two choices. You can continue to think that way, and therefore you're going to continue to frame yourself, i.e. look for situations to validate that you're still struggling so that you can maintain this belief system. Otherwise, it might launch you into existential crisis. Like, who am I if I'm not struggling? Or you can shift your perception and say, yeah, I did struggle, it made me strong. My ancestors struggled, it led me, you know, gave me inner strength, it gave me support, it gave me, you know, so much more understanding. And that's allowed me to no longer struggle. Now, what's next for me? I've created this strength that actually will now make me thrive when everyone else is still trying to figure things out. So you have the choice. It's not what the statistics say. It's not what history even says. It's not what, say, the reality is, because all the reality is what's serving you in this moment and what you're deciding to perpetuate as something that's a dead belief or something that's could potentially serve you in changing.
There's not a dead belief if I still see my
because
brother
being
shot.
But because you have the belief, you will still see that. So it's confirmation
bias.
It's not because you're choosing to, right. So in any given moment, there's hundreds and thousands of bits of information, things that you could focus on. You have no choice. When you've embedded a belief in your brain will help you see and validate that belief. It's confirmation bias. It will cause you to notice, remember, and weigh all things, anything and everything you can to validate that belief. At the same time, it'll cause you to not notice, not remember, and not weigh things that counter that belief. So yes, they're still getting shot, right? Still black men getting shot, black women, whatever. Racism existing. And there's some of that not happening. You're not gonna see that because you're choosing to keep that belief. So your brain is going to show you this. If you've got this, you know, space, if this big crowd in front of you, you, without noticing it, are going to zone in on instances that are going to validate any of the beliefs that you have versus anything that's counter to that.
But I think the other argument is that if I don't make a bunch of noise around when those incidents happen, you're in the majority. You're going to stop thinking that it happens. And that's a problem for me.
You don't know that. You don't know me.
I've known history. And the history in this country is that I'm sorry you're the representative of all white people at this particular time, but you will not ever acknowledge that it happens if I don't make you identify it. And unfortunately, for you to identify
it, but that's the thing, you're trying to make me notice something that you don't know, even if you do make noise, if I'm gonna change it all. And in the meantime—
But isn't that an issue then? Isn't that a problem that I have no idea, but I know it's not gonna happen.
Again,
I know it's not gonna happen if I don't show you.
You don't know that. You don't know that. Because it's about what.
But if it keeps happening, if it keeps happening from the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the same shit keeps happening, what have you done? What have you done, representative of all white women and all white people in the country?
But I can make similar arguments about being a woman.
And this is why I asked that question earlier. Do women, powerful women, who ascribe to live the power, the Salem witch power, if you would, the religious freedom, the sexual independence that you want as a human being who happens to be in the form of a woman, do you have to be criminally deviant in a sense to do that?